Welcome to the New York City Bar Association podcast. The judiciary is poised for transformation in the AI era. Only one thing is clear for the future of the court, and it's that nothing is clear.
The legal profession is going to go through a transformative period that will take somewhere in the vicinity of 3 to 5 years to really see where the dust is settling. And even then, the dust won't be settled.
Judges are going to have to learn when and how to appropriately use AI, just like with all of the other resources at their disposal.
Just like a law clerk can assist and is essential to the judge doing the job, but the judge can't use the law clerk as a substitute for the judge deciding. Same with these generative AI.
Even as the risks and the wrinkles get ironed out, the potential opportunities created by AI are undeniably exciting.
I think that one of the true benefits of generative AI tools will be enabling access to justice both for pro se litigants, but also for legal service organizations.
Opinions expressed are those of the speakers and not necessarily of the City Bar.
Hello, my name is Farouk Manassian, founder and chair of the New York City Bar Association's Working Group on Judicial Administration and Artificial Intelligence and a judicial law clerk. I'm joined today by two former federal district court judges to discuss how AI will affect the federal judiciary. By background, the working group is a joint committee between the City Bar's Council on Judicial Administration and the City Bar's Task Force on Digital Technologies. This working group is preparing a report with recommendations on addressing AI use within the New York State judiciary. I'm joined today by Judge Catherine Forrest, who served as a U.S. District Court judge for the Southern District of New York from 2011 to 2018. Judge Forrest frequently writes and speaks on AI issues. She is now a partner at Paul Weiss, where she co-chairs the firm's digital practice group. I'm also joined by Judge Paul Grimm, who served as a U.S. District Court judge for the District of Maryland from 2012 to 2022, and as a magistrate judge there from 1997 to 2012. Judge Grimm frequently writes and speaks about AI and evidence issues, and is now a professor at Duke Law School, as well as a director of the law school's Bulk Judicial Institute. Both judges serve on the American Bar Association's Task Force on Law and AI, and both have presented before the working group. Before we continue, an important disclaimer. No one here represents the views of the judiciary, federal or otherwise. AI will affect every sector of society, including the judiciary. How that impact will look like is to be determined. Judges, if you were still an active federal district court judge, how, if at all, would you incorporate AI into your work?
First of all, thank you, Harut, for having me. You know, today in 2024, we're at the beginning of 2024. We're still at a time when the AI tools that are available, widely available, are relatively still in the early stages, and we're going to see numerous advances. So if I were not in my office at Paul Weiss, but sitting instead back in chambers, I would still be in a situation where I would be concerned about certain of the hallucination issues that are continue to be around the tools, some of the confidentiality issues that continue to be around the tools. There are still lots of licensing issues to be worked out in terms of how the judiciary is going to be able to access some of the best legal tools. So I would be watching very closely the developments in this area. I would be trying to get myself a beta license so that I and my clerks would be able to experiment with these tools, but I'm not sure they would become part of any kind of regular cadence of research or usage. Just as they are today in my private practice, they would be part of, I think, really an experimental piece. They'd be part of an analysis as to where things are going.
Couldn't agree more with Judge Forrest. I think she's exactly right. Right now, U.S. courts are recipients of information that is the product of artificial intelligence software applications. And we've seen some notorious, I think that's not too great a word to say, miscues where lawyers have not done what lawyers are always expected to do, which is to check their work and make sure that cases that were produced from generative AI programs were real cases and applied to the facts of the case. So we've been on the receiving end of AI. On the using end, I think we're exactly where Judge Forrest said we are. We know that this technology is developing explosively. We know that there is tremendous investment in this. billions of dollars. And I think Judge Forrest is exactly right. I think that this conversation a year from now or 2 years from now might be quite different. One of the things, of course, the use of technology within the courts, there's sort of an interesting issue, and I'd be interested on hearing Judge Forrest's take on this, is that it's one thing for each individual judge or each court to have policies that tell parties who are using artificial intelligence to prepare filings in court what their obligations are. That's one thing, because that's information coming into the court. It still has to be filed according to the court's PACER system, and is picked up on CMECF, the case management system of the federal courts. But I think that there will be an interesting issue to see whether we get any guidance from the administrative office of the U.S. courts as to whether or not courts can use internally artificial intelligence applications to be able to try to use them, and whether they will be having any kind of a guidance or even restrictions on how that might be, for exactly the reasons why Judge Forrest said. You have to worry about confidentiality, you have to worry about hallucinations. And judges, I think, are going to be cautious to make sure that what they are doing, you know, the Constitution vests in the individual judge the authority and the responsibility to decide their cases. And you can't sort of, just like a law clerk can assist and is essential to the judge doing the job, but the judge can't use the law clerk as a substitute for the judge deciding. Same with these generative AI. I know of one federal judge who I feel I respect very highly, who is going to do an experiment with a bench trial that judge has conducted in having the interns and the law clerks prepare the findings of facts and conclusions of law based upon a very extensive record, and then come up with those. And then having that data, this is done with the party's knowledge and consent, they're going to run that through some artificial intelligence software applications that the judge has gotten the ability to use and the parties have agreed to, and then compare the results and to see how accurately it did what I think artificial intelligence software applications have the promise of doing, which is looking at vast amounts of information and summarizing them, and to see whether they're accurately doing that in a way that you can rely upon and pointing you to a transcript where you can check it, or whether they're sort of hallucinating. So I think you'll see the more sort of forward-leaning federal judges, like Judge Forrest when she was on the bench. I would not ever describe myself as forward-leaning in terms of the use of technology, although I spent a lot of time thinking about its legal implications. But I think we'll see some of the forward-leaning judges sort of experimenting and trying to see if we can test these applications, but we're a bit away from a widespread use, although the promise is quite great.
Yeah, and Harut, let me just add one more thing to what Judge Grimm has just said, which is, actually, I want to add two things. One is to just recognize that AI is actually used, series of machine learning tools are actually used in judicial systems all over the country today. And that's in the form of various kinds of predictive software that have been around for almost now a decade in various forms that relate to some of the predictive guidelines and predictive tools. When I say guidelines, I don't mean the sentencing guidelines. I mean predictive guidelines as to whether or not judges should grant bail, whether they should allow certain convicted defendants to access certain programs in the criminal justice area. The federal system uses a tool called PICRA that is a machine learning tool. So there is utilization of narrow AI already in the judicial system. But in terms of using it in our courtrooms, I think that's really what we're talking about in terms of the new generation of very powerful generative AI tools. And one thing I was going to add are certain use cases that will present, not today, but they will present, I think, certain issues to judges over the next year or two as to whether or not they're going to allow it, which is, for instance, let's say you've gotten a filing that's a public filing, no redacted material. There's nothing that's confidential in that in that particular filing. And you can upload it or could upload it in the future when the accuracy rates increase and get much better and determine with the tool whether or not the tool has ideas as to whether or not the litigant has gotten certain things right or gotten certain things wrong. I, doing an experiment just yesterday, uploaded a document that was a complaint that is not a complaint that I'm actually involved with in any way, but just to sort of play with this tool. asked it to give me the best reasons for a motion to dismiss. It was in an area of the law that I know very well, antitrust. And it came up with some really very interesting ideas that I didn't check out all of the cases it cited, but the ones that I recognized on their face were quite accurate. So these tools have enormous potential, but we'll also be facing some questions about the appropriate utilization of the tools once we've actually gotten the tools to the level where the accuracy concerns, the confidentiality concerns are resolved. Then we're going to face phase two of appropriateness. You know, as Judge Grimm said, you know, the judges have constitutional authority and obligations to make the decisions themselves.
So that's an excellent point that Judge Forrest makes. It's a mistake to think of artificial intelligence software applications as monolithic. The analytical, predictive types of programs that Judge Forrest has described have been around for a long time and are actually being used right now. I mean, if you use Grammarly right now to try to check your grammar, that's being done by artificial intelligence algorithms. Westlaw and Lexis are using artificial intelligence in terms of trying to search for information. And theoretically, their database are legitimate cases. So if you put a search in there and you get a case, it should not be a hallucinatory case. Now, the case may not stand for the proposition that you asked for, but at least it should be a real case. So the generative AI, where it actually goes in and looks for content and then produces something that can be enormously used, such as the here are seven grounds for a motion to dismiss, ranked in order of strongest to least strong. They can also look at a brief and see whether or not the parties have cited the controlling law that governs this area of law. So then if they've left out a recent case or a dispositive case or a case in that circuit and haven't discussed it, then it can highlight that. So these tools are going to have use. They're going to get better. They're going to have a greater accuracy rate. We already know that we're in ChatGPT 4.5, which has much better accuracy than ChatGPT 3. So as we go forward, we will see more of those. And then we will get to the notion of what are the appropriate ways for judges to use them. Where they can really help is, you know, Judge Forrest and I can talk about, you know, the frequency with which you get very extensive filings, very extensive factual records. And it would be nice to be able to know that before you dive into a 150-page expert report, it would be nice to have that executive summary as to what that report is saying that you could look at so that at least you knew how it was going to be laid out. You have to still look at it. You have to still do the work that you have to do. But the ability to summarize and encapsulate is really remarkable. I'll give you a non-legal example that is beguiling to me. I, from time to time, will shop on Amazon. My wife will tell you it's more frequently than time to time. But nonetheless, and what I would always try to do in the past is I would always want to look at the stars and see what the ratings were. You know, and there would be, it would be 4.5 stars. And there would be, you know, some that said, oh, this is great. You know, this is wonderful. And then there would be like one or two saying, oh, this is a big mistake. And I would kind of just have to scroll down and do my own little unrandom sampling. But now, if you look at Amazon, it says artificial intelligence summarizes. Most people say blah, 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 blah. A few people have pointed out blah, 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 blah. And so it's a nice little summary of what those 2,200 comments say. As that gets more accurate, this can have really good impact on where we're going.
So one of the major domains that AI will affect within the judiciary is the law of evidence. What are some great challenges that you see at that intersection between AI and evidence?
You know, I think that we're right now confronting, even before, you know, in our prior conversation, it was about things that are to come and what's going to be happening in the relatively near future, but what's on the horizon. The evidentiary issues are a today issue. We've got now the world of deepfakes upon us. And deepfakes are, you know, made with generative AI tools, and they are able to take audio and video snippets and make them into much longer segments. They're able to delete video from video and actually cover up what was there before with something else that looks realistic. They're able to place an image in a video that didn't exist. They're able to take voices and make them say things that they didn't say. So the ability to utilize some of the fundamental types of evidence that have been standard ways of trying to figure out the truth, what really happened, namely audio and video, those are now subject to additional questions. There are going to be many cases where this is never going to come up, and there are going to be cases where it does come up and where we're starting to see it come up. Did this really happen? Or at least an allegation, that's not me. And then we're going to have the race towards how do we figure out whether or not this video has been doctored with or not doctored with. We've already got the race towards finding technologies that can determine whether or not something is a deepfake. This is a here and now issue that's becoming ever more complicated. Last week, you know, OpenAI announced Sora. And Sora is a new generation of large language models called the multimodal models. And these MLLMs or multimodal LLMs are really going to take off in 2024. But one of the things that they do is they take deepfakes as well as other kinds of content, but they're going to really turbocharge those in terms of the realism. So this is a here and now issue that we're already seeing in terms of whether or not we can rely upon the standard evidence that courtrooms have had trotted in forever.
This is a very important point Judge Forrest makes. I couldn't agree with it more. The challenge that we have right now is that when you're dealing with audio, visual, and audio visual, the province of deepfakes, several things are going on. First of all, they're getting extremely good. They now can have background breathing so that if a person's talking, you can hear, you know, the kind of pauses when someone takes a breath that was one of the tells you could look at to see if it was a real recording or not. Everyone's got a cell phone or a smartphone. The frequency with which some sort of photographic audio or audio visual evidence is offered is ubiquitous, and it's one of the most important types of evidence. These can be very graphic. You can have someone imagine, and we're starting to see it already, and I think I have great concerns about this in this election cycle, where you could have with going on YouTube or something and getting a speech that a politician made, and then with a minute of that, making a program where that politician on voting day comes out and says, don't even bother voting, the election's been done, I concede, don't bother to vote. Something like that goes out in the public and immediately is absorbed and can have very realistic effects. What happens when you get in the courtroom? The key evidentiary issue with the deepfakes, because it's audio visual and audio visual, pictorial and oral, is authentication. And authentication only needs to be established by a preponderance of the evidence, which is 51%, and it's little more than a coin toss. The other thing is when you get the situation that Judge Forrest capably described, where one side says, I'll give you a specific, you know, sort of a simple example. I say, I got a voicemail on my cell phone, and it was a threatening message from someone who I've known for years. I know how they speak. I know what their voice is. I can tell you that's their voice, and they threatened me. Now, under evidence rule 901B5, opinion as to voice is sufficient to authenticate it. If I've known that person, I've known her for years, that authenticates it. If that person then says, that's a fake, I didn't do it, I was elsewhere, I was with someone else, now you've got a dispute of fact as to whether or not that voicemail was authentic or not. So unlike most evidentiary battles, you know, okay, is it hearsay or is it not hearsay? We at least know we're arguing about whether it's hearsay. With deepfakes, there's not an agreement as to what we're arguing over. One side says it's legitimate, one side says it's real. And under the evidence rules, under Rule 104B, conditional relevance, the trial judge doesn't decide. If a reasonable jury could decide that it was authentic, then the fact dispute goes to the jury and they have to see, hear the evidence on both sides, which means the jury will be exposed to the evidence that can be so graphic that a judge might have Rule 403 prejudice concerns, But the judge doesn't get to make that decision because the jury has to decide if it's authentic. If it's not authentic, they reject it. If it is, they hear it. This is a weakness. It's not a weakness, but it's a gap in the existing rules of evidence to deal with this. I'm very concerned about this. My colleague, Professor Maura Grossman, who I've written a number of articles on evidentiary aspects, we have proposed a deepfake rule to the Evidence Rules Advisory Committee. We submitted that. They'll be considering it when they meet sometime this spring. That will have a new standard that would make it easier to suss these things out and have a workable framework that would help us deal with some of these challenges. We've also proposed an authentication rule for artificial intelligence that's acknowledged to be AI. But Judge Forrest is right. This is a right now problem. And there are no cases, reported cases I've seen, because I'm monitoring this, to deal with it. There's some articles I've written it, that Judge Forrest has spoken and written on it. We're just beginning to face this, and we're going to have to deal with it.
Yeah, and let me just add to that, that in criminal cases, this is going to be a particular problem. You know, in a civil case, if you've got a tort situation and someone says the truck swerved this way and, you know, inches matter, and you've got a video showing that it sort of swerved from the poll camera slightly differently, that's one thing. It's a tort case. All right, it's got real implications. It's very important to the litigants and all of that. But when you have a jury that is sitting to trying to determine if someone is going to actually be convicted of a serious crime, and their standard of proof is, you know, beyond a reasonable doubt, it's not beyond all doubt, but beyond a reasonable doubt, these kinds of questions could end up mattering. And so we're going to have some real sort of struggles as we work our way through this. And let me also just mention the asymmetries that can develop in terms of access to the resources, the financial resources that are going to be required for litigants to be able to put up the expert witnesses and the evidence that will actually authenticate or attempt to, you know, object to the proffer from the other side, in terms of whether or not a deep fake is or is not, or a piece of video or audio is or is not real. These are going to be expensive, expert-driven endeavors, and there could be an asymmetry there. I do want to mention that there is a lot right now in the world of algorithmic bias that courts are dealing with in terms of output issues, in terms of a credit and lending decision that may or may not have a biased result, a human resources decision that may be claimed to be based upon a biased output. And one of the things right now that's becoming more complex is determining whether or not there is intentional discrimination when the claim of bias resides within the operation of the tool. So with narrow AI, it used to be that there was somebody who was choosing a data set. Perhaps the data set was knowingly non-representative, or it was in reckless disregard, or it was just unintentional. The algorithm might have been actually, the weightings might have been changed by a human. But now we actually have the ability to use those same tools in a generative AI context, where determining what the weightings are, determining how the model took in those outputs, the inputs rather, and then created the outputs, those are very complicated. So determining ultimately intentionality, lack of intentionality, whether or not there's been reckless disregard, those are also going to be issues that courts are going to have to determine. And so that's another sort of struggle we're going to have down the road.
To that point, I will say what we've always been able to do in the past is that one of the ways that you can tell whether or not you have, when a search has been done through algorithmic evidence, is whether it can be replicated. You put the prompts in and you see what the, and you can go backwards and see how it happened. Some of these new software applications, you can't tell how they applied the factors and did the weighting. So it's going to make it very challenging. And I will say that in the criminal context, everyone is very concerned about that asymmetry, because the government is going to have the resources that the government always has in criminal cases, but the defense, and even in the federal system, the public defenders have funds where they can hire experts, but the Criminal Justice Act counsel have to actually file a motion with the court to get access to experts, and there are oftentimes caps on what the courts will authorize. There are some highly competent and very well-respected people who have expertise in this area. I'm thinking of Professor Hani Farid from Berkeley, whose whole expertise is authentication of digital information. And he says this is getting so good that it's hard even for the experts to authenticate. So you're going to need access to people with the qualifications to do this. Again, we are here now with that, and we have policy as well as evidentiary issues that we're going to have to deal with.
Judge Grimm, over the past year, federal judges and state judges across the country have issued orders requiring attorneys to disclose their use of AI. Other courts have issued reminders about professional responsibility. What are your views on these requirements, these orders requiring attorneys to disclose that they've used AI or otherwise reminding them about their professional responsibilities?
I'm very sympathetic to what motivates the judges to do that, because we've had, and the astonishing thing is we continue to get reports. I mean, just last week, a intermediate appellate court in Missouri sanctioned a self-represented individual $10,000. Actually cited an article that Professor Grossman and I wrote in terms of, you know, that they cited cases that did not have a basis, in fact, and they were actually sanctioned for that, a substantial sanction. And lawyers are still doing that. It comes up, it seems like, about once or twice a month still. So I'm very sympathetic to that impulse. I have no qualms with what I would say is that the way that I think is the best way to approach this existing problem, which is real, is to come up with a local rule that applies to an entire court. And the reason for that is that when you have a local rule, you publish it and you can get input. In some instances, the orders, the individual standing orders that judges have issued, have been overbroad, and they've said you can't use AI, but they don't mean Grammarly and they don't mean spell check. They mean if you've used something that's generative AI to draft pleadings or make arguments, that you have an obligation, regardless of what method you use to get the information you file, to make sure that you complied with your ethical obligation as an attorney with the rules of civil procedure, Rule 11, Rule 26G, if it's a discovery matter. So those have always been there. And I don't have any quarrel with warning people about upfront what those obligations are and saying, if you don't do that, then there can be sanctions. And I don't have any quarrel with orders that say you have to disclose if you've used that. But I think the challenge I have that is one I worry about when, if you have multiple judges on a single court having disparate orders, or lawyers who frequently practice in many jurisdictions dealing with multiple and sometimes not consistent disclosure and certification requirements. I favor, frankly, this being done through the local rules process so that there is notice and an opportunity, for example, for the bar that's going to be affected by this to say, whoa, you said this, but do you mean for this to apply to this situation? Then you can clarify that and come up with a rule that applies for the entire district. And that, I think, is less of a maze that the lawyers might have to weave their way through to make sure they're complying with these individual orders. But I'm sympathetic to the impulse. I wish there was more uniformity and there was more advanced opportunity for the people affected to comment to make sure that they're not ambiguities or that it's not overbroad.
And let me just throw in one more thought, which is, when the rollout of the Microsoft 365 suite occurs that's going to have generative AI embedded throughout, some of the compliance with the question, did you use generative AI in connection with your creation of this legal filing, or thou shalt not, those are going to become a little bit more complex, and we're going to have to start grappling with the ubiquity of the various tools' embeddedness in what we're using every day just to sort of do our basic legal research and work anyway, without going to any really specialized tools.
Judge Forrest, AI has the potential to democratize legal services. Self-represented parties could use AI to make competent pleadings, et cetera. How do you see AI affecting access to justice issues?
I think that one of the true benefits of generative AI tools will be enabling access to justice both for pro se litigants, but also for legal service organizations that have tremendously, you know, long dockets, where it's going to free up some time on tasks that they'll be able to actually do much more quickly. But I do think that there are a few caveats that we have to bear in mind. One is, what quality of tool will pro se litigants have available to them? Because if all they've got is a free version of a tool with lower accuracy, doesn't have the confidentiality guardrails around it, and you have to pay $19.99 a month to get the higher quality, you still may not have the guardrails for confidentiality around it. They don't have access to Harvey. You know, so we could be giving pro se litigants a less than adequate tool for this access to justice. And I think we have to watch that. That's one thing. It's still probably better than nothing. We also have to warn them of, and hopefully the hallucinations and the inaccuracies will be solved. But the other issue, I think that we'll need to grapple with pro se litigants is whether or not they understand what is being generated for them. What we don't want is a situation where someone writes down a fact pattern and says, do I have a claim? And if I do, please draft me a complaint. And suddenly a statute pops up and various cases pop up. And the individual really doesn't understand that what they had to meet was a standard of alleging under all kinds of rules that require the truth to be told in their pleadings, that there was intentional conduct on the other side, or that there was, that they did or did not do X or Y, and that this was a fundamental aspect of the claim that they pled. And they might then say, I didn't know that's what was happening. I just put in my facts and outspit this complaint. So we'll also have to be careful that they understand what it is that's being filed. Because having a tool that can write like a lawyer for somebody does not mean that you've got that lawyer. That tool may or may not be then orally explaining what that pleading means to that individual. So I've got great hope for the ability of these tools to lead to additional access to justice. But I don't think that we can just sort of flip the switch, allow the tools loose with pro se litigants, think our problems with pro se litigants not having access to justice have been solved. I think that there are many other questions we're going to need to be asking and solving.
Yeah, I agree with that. There are a lot of folks who are interested in this area, and I think that there is a real recognition of the potential, unrealized as yet, but there are projects that are actually trying to develop reliable artificial intelligence modalities for legal access to legal services. But again, those of us who have been judges and have dealt with self-represented litigants, even those who have the best intentions and are really struggling trying to do it the right way, not the vexatious litigants, not the people who clog up the system and purposely fail to follow the rules and the procedures and the court orders, but there are a lot of people who just don't have the resources. We have a tremendous access to justice disparity in this country. And it's not just people who have very little means, but people who have, that are middle-class folks who just can't afford a lawyer, and they're going into court to try to represent themselves. So there's a lot of promise there, but to make sure that they're not being snookered, so to speak, by this, and you have to understand that they may be acting completely in good faith, but they don't know what is happening or the accuracy of it, this is going to have to be developed to a point where we have better confidence in how reliable it is so that they can use these tools and get that benefit that we hope that they can achieve.
If there's any takeaway that judges and lawyers should take from AI, what would it be?
My takeaway is that the legal profession is going to go through a transformative period that will take somewhere in the vicinity of 3 to 5 years to really see where the dust is settling. And even then, the dust won't be settled because this is an evolutionary tool that will continue to adjust. The transformative nature of this tool really can't be overstated. We're going to see the true end of the billable hour. We're going to see adjustments in how law students are taught. We're going to see adjustments in the footprint that law firms have to get their work done. And we're going to see all kinds of changes. And I see this as one of the most transformative moments in the legal profession.
I will agree that this is transformative. I was talking to somebody, I don't know who it was, they were at a bar conference where they had the managing partners from a large number of law firms who were there. And they said, what are the three biggest concerns your firms are focusing on now? And the managing partner of a very substantial, well-known national firm said, Yes, those three concerns, AI, AI, and AI. And so they know that, and they're moving into that. There will be ethical obligations that if you could do it faster, cheaper, better using these technologies, and you don't do it, then that's going to be an ethical issue. There will be confidentiality issues where firms are using information about their clients to build models that they use within their own firm to analyze things. And does that require advanced disclosure and consent? There'll be confidentiality issues. Where is this data stored? Who can have access to it? So there'll be a lot of issues there. But the utility of this technology and the ability for what's going to happen is going to be amazing. And we're not there right now, but we're getting close. And as Judge Forrest said, the corporate and institutional general counsels are going to require that their counsel have proficiency in this because they're not going to pay for inefficiencies. And I might add that the obligation now, I think, is with the law schools, which have not done a great job with just sort of standard electronically stored information discovery, teaching those mechanics because they don't spend a lot of time on discovery in civil procedure, whereas that's what you spend most of your time with in civil practice. We have an obligation to our students to make sure that they know how these tools operate, the limitations and the promise, so that when they come out, they can be the ones that can help their, shall we say, those lawyers in their firm with more time at the bar, but less technical expertise.
Thank you so much for your time and perspective.
It was a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the New York City Bar Association podcast. Opinions expressed are those of the speakers and not necessarily of the City Bar. If you enjoy this podcast, please like and subscribe wherever you listen. Find more City Bar podcasts on Apple, Spotify, Google, iHeart, or at our website at www.nycbar.org/podcasts. Be sure to check out This Lawyer's Life, a professional development podcast where we talk with lawyers about seizing opportunities, learning lessons the hard way, and about what makes them tick. And don't miss Building Belonging, a podcast that embraces authentic conversations about DEIB solutions by amplifying the most marginalized voices in the legal industry and exploring spaces others dare not. This podcast was produced and edited by Eli Cohen.